It is so much fun to be with Sevilla again today. The last time we saw each other was at Chino at the conference, A Quest for a Spiritual Home. And we're just eager to get together and talk about our experiences there. And Sevilla, I was kind of hoping that you could jumpstart this and just talk about what it was like for you. I mean, you had a long way to fly in because you came all the way from DC, right?
Yeah, that's right. It was a great experience. I mean, let me compare it a little bit to, it was a different vibe from Thunder Bay, where things were sort of just getting started. But I certainly noticed,
So, for the people who are tuning in who don't know anything about this, okay? So, Thunder Bay, Ontario was the location for a previous
Yeah,
conference.
and that was in September, and I think I've got the thing from the bag from that. It's right here. That was called Conscious and Consciousness, and they gave out this bag with the
Oh,
pictures of
very cool.
that
those are.
was actually
So that's let's see, that's John Bravecki,
here.
Jonathan Peugeot, and then going
Paul
around.
Vanderplay, and this is, I don't remember his name, unfortunately, but it was the doctor from the local university who, cognitive psychologist, I think. And so he was fourth, kind of like John Van Donk was the fourth this time.
And so it was just part of sort of this little corner, getting together and trying to figure things out the way we've been trying to figure things out online for the last 4 years.
And so that was, and it, and this one was very similar. Catherine organized it in pretty much the same way and had the fourth person, so you could have the two split off dialogues and then all four talking together. And it was, that was interesting the way they did that. It worked well in both cases, very different in both cases. But what I noticed in Chino is, you certainly had a lot of young men coming together looking for, I guess, not so much, not so much of the Jordan Peterson thing where, I mean, there's a similarity where they've lost in the world because of the way men are being treated lately, and Jordan Peterson has, given them confidence and tools to get back in the world in a meaningful and proper way. So there was that, to the extent that the whole spirituality aspect, the whole and mostly these guys were Christians, so a lot of young guys coming to Christianity or have been Christian and trying to figure it out, what way they're going to go with it. Are they going to do the church of their youth? Are they going to move on to some other denomination? Are they going to go Orthodox like a lot of these guys are doing? Or did they, did they ditch it and then get back into it? And that was sort of happening in Thunder Bay. I noticed that, but really, I noticed this in Chino, where the young men, and I guess maybe it's because of the estuary that really brought it front and center, is you got, these up close and personal expositions of people's quests, which is exactly what the whole Chino conference was about, was that
Well,
quest.
okay, so in Thunder Bay, then are you saying that you didn't have the estuary experiences in Thunder Bay?
They did. It just wasn't emphasized the way it was here, where everyone did it. You could do it. Paul offered it like as a sideline one night, but
Oh, okay.
this one, it was really emphasized, and everyone did it, and everyone did it every day.
Yeah, I was
That
trying
was
to
the
remember. It
big
seems to
difference.
me we had like three sessions the first day and then one session the last day.
Well, I think we ended up, I mean, I think I had to miss one for some reason, but there was something like that. So that was the big difference. And so you really got to hear what these guys, mostly young men, were not exclusively, obviously, we were there. But and actually that's the other demographic I noticed is women our age. Probably that was the second biggest demographic.
Yeah, is that what is that? Why do you think that is? I mean, there were some young women there. There were some young women there, and I kind of noticed that among the young women, the demographic was that they were either in tech or they were artists,
Yeah, that's right. That's very true.
which is I just it's very interesting.
Well, a lot of what happened this time, this was another big difference too, is you got people flying in, but you had so many people that were local in both situations. So you had a lot more Canadians in Thunder Bay, and you had a ton of people from Southern California at this one, which makes sense. So I think the tech and the artistic part might have been that.
Yeah, and then there were some couples. That was kind of surprising to me, because it seems like what I hear from people, and that's certainly my own experience too, that it's usually only one member of a couple that is kind of into this thing, and the other one can't figure out why are you into this thing? What does this all mean, you know? So, yeah, so starting from the beginning, when you got there, you said did you notice right away that there was a different vibe, and what was the difference in the vibe?
Well, I mean, the churches were very, very different, for one. I mean, you really like in Thunder Bay, it's sort of a humble church that sort of just got started. And it was this kind of one room church that was associated. What really stood out there was they had this fantastic coffee shop, and that's how they did their, that's what financed a lot of it, I think. They were more focused on, reaching out to the Thunder Bay is very economically is not very successful economically, and there are a lot of social services around, and a lot of people you see around there you can tell are not are kind of down and out. So that church really served that community, whereas this church, was really it was kind of fancy, and I had never been to anything like that, actually.
Well, it was sort of like a campus almost, because
It's like a campus, yeah.
they had their main building, and then they had some other buildings that were for like educational purposes and preschool, and maybe even like a community building or something like
Yeah.
that. It was more like a campus.
Yeah, that's right. And that's the big, that was an obvious big difference.
Well, so I mean, I'm very familiar with churches like that because they're kind of all over the place. And there are fewer, maybe, of the kind of church that you're talking about in Thunder Bay, partly because Thunder Bay has its own vibe. Like you said, it's more of an economically distressed area. And
Very, yeah, which is
so the
really
churches
awesome.
there would naturally be more focused on that. Although, I'm sure that the church that we were at in Southern California would be pretty similar to the church that I'm at, which is not anything like the size of that Chino campus, but very outward focused, doing a lot of community services kind of things. But it's not as obvious, because when you look at the church building, it's a little bit more substantial.
Oh, no doubt. I mean, we even saw that they, have these programs for the poor there and in other countries. So I thought that church really does a lot. But it was just like its obvious role of the other church was serving, the community, and they'd have dementia patients come in. It was, I don't know if it was weekly or daily. It might have been weekly. And everything sort of centered around the free lunch that they had in the basement for the community and the coffee shop, which was the public large. But this was really, I mean, a totally different vibe church-wise. And that was my first experience with a church like that. I've been to the Episcopal Church, I've been to the Catholic Church, and because of social work, I've been to the urban Baptist churches. But I'd never been to anything like that.
Well, it's
Like
one of the
church.
things that I thought was really fun and kind of fascinating was that the local people of the church were the ones who did all the serving at mealtime and everything. And took care of keeping all the rooms ready for us and cleaning up afterwards at the end of the day. And that was really interesting to me because almost every other conference I've been at, or like I've been to some like training programs that go on for weeks at a time, and typically the participants are the ones that part of the program is that the participants take responsibility for their own care, serving themselves at meals and cleaning up together afterwards. And that's sort of team building in a way when you do that.
That makes
But
sense.
here we were free to think and process and talk. We didn't have to take care of any details. And so that was pretty nice.
Yeah, it was. And what else is, well, I guess what more about that situation? Well, I mean, I think these, like, you really saw the, because this channel that's developed in between, maybe before Thunder Bay, but I'm not sure, you know, with and you had a couple of the guys on your you've had three of them lately. You had Chad, and you had Teo, and then you had a third fellow who I didn't get a chance to see that one.
Ted,
Ted, that's it. Yeah.
and then Justin.
And
Maybe Justin hasn't published yet. That's going to publish in a couple of days.
Yeah, but Justin's been getting involved too, so that's great.
Yeah.
It's a lot more of him lately. But that, like, that group that sort of, I guess it's the Bridges of Meaning Discord where they came from, but they have their own channel where they do something every Friday.
Oh, really?
It's called the Friday Morning Nameless.
Oh, that's Chad's channel.
Oh, is that Chad's channel?
Yeah. So he's getting more. That's great that he's doing more stuff.
I,
Cool.
for some reason I thought Jacob was doing that, but Jacob's got his own channel too. So I noticed a lot more of that, you know, vibe there, those guys and the people who went on their channels and kind of circulated around those channels. And that really set the tone there, I think.
I think Jacob's channel is called Just Chatting, maybe, or yeah, okay.
Or his last name, Facciarucci.
Yeah.
Facciarucci.
Yeah. Yeah. So what was, how did it feel to you meeting people in person that you had only seen online before?
Well, I got, you know, with the regular, you know, with John and Paul and Jonathan, you know, I'd already been through that, so it was great to see them again. But it was really like meeting Grim Grizz was great.
Yeah.
You know, that was interesting to see him in person because he's such a, you know, he's got such as he's a strong presence.
Yes. Yeah, he's definitely a strong presence, strong personality, and kind of a center. People center, people gather around him. So he's got a kind of a natural leadership
I
quality
think
about
you're
him.
right. He
Yeah.
absolutely does. And, you know, just being so brilliant and also that whole, the way he characterized himself as the, you know, the wise fool of the corner, I think is, you know, and symbolically, I think that is his role. You know, the person who points out all the undercurrents in what's going on.
And you taught a class while
Oh, Jacob did that. That was really great. He just kind of made it happen, you know, out of the blue. There was a old, very old psychiatrist who is a member of that church, and he's in his 90s, and he's a friend of John Van Donk's. So Jacob, and there was, you know, several mental health practitioners there. Probably there could have been more involved because, you know, there was a couple of VA psychiatrists and a couple other therapists, but he just did it ad hoc. He knew that I was a therapist, so he just got us together on stage, you know, for like Ken Lowry, sort of as a facilitator, and then me and the psychiatrist whose name eludes me, and then John Van Dock, And so we just sort of talked about our roles as practitioners and what mental health, what the practice of how the concept of practicing and maintaining good mental health is in relation to also the spiritual quest, because it is part of it.
Well, so what kind of things did you talk about in there? Because I didn't get to see that. I was in the main hall when that happened.
Paul posted it. I can send you a link. It was short. It was only maybe half an hour. And basically, the psychiatrist and I talked about our practice experiences. Was you know, he's 90, so he obviously was a psychoanalyst, because all therapists were psychoanalysts up to some point in the 20th century. That's how it's done, and mostly it was psychiatrists who were psychoanalysts.
Well, so that's an interesting question for me. What is the difference now then between a therapist and a psychoanalyst?
Well, psychoanalysts in the past, you'd go there 4 or 5 days a week, and you just kind of free associate, and every now and then someone, the psychiatrist will interject or notice something about what you're talking about and draw your attention to something you probably haven't noticed before. And days and days and days of this, and often over the course of years. That's how it was practiced back in the sometimes you see these movies in the 70s, like Woody Allen, and they're going to their analyst. So that's what it was. But psychotherapy, started switching at some point in the 20th century to, all the forms we see nowadays. And that's just once a week for the most part. So that's the
And the
difference.
forms we see nowadays would be like
Well, you have things.
cognitive behavioral therapy and
Yeah.
dialectical behavioral therapy
That's
and
right.
EMDR and all of these various things. So do you practice a particular vein of that, or is it like you target it towards your client, or how does that work?
Well, my postgraduate, not after graduate school, I did another 2-year-long program in something called psychodynamic psychotherapy, which is it's a modern form of psychoanalysis to some degree. It draws from those concepts in that school. But I know some basic CBT concepts. I mean, every therapist does, because some of that stuff is a really good tool. And so most of us do something else. We do other interventions, and then people will practice, they'll go get a certificate and interventions sort of layer them onto what they do. And nowadays people don't, people seem to want, because of TikTok and stuff, people seem to want things like EMDR or things that seem to be short term and effective in a short term.
Like rapid response therapy, RRT, is that correct? Is that the right?
I've never heard that particular.
Well, there's some sort of new thing where sometimes they can get the result within 1 or 2 sessions and then you're done.
Yeah, I would find that hard to
I mean, I've talked to some people who've gone through it, and they said it was completely remarkable.
Right.
Because it's probably a compression of the psychoanalytical thing where the person is talking and somehow the therapist is able to get them targeted in on whatever the significant thing was in their life that created this problem, and then kind of open that up. And I mean, I've heard a couple of really remarkable stories from people.
What did you hear? Can you share one of the stories?
Not without revealing too much about the person. Yeah, can't do that. But
Well, of course not. Yeah.
they had gone through many other different kinds of therapies, which could have had their impact. So I
Sure.
mean,
Yeah.
right? So they might have been well prepared for this, because maybe all the other therapies kind of helped them zone in on what the main problem was. So maybe that allowed this rapid response therapist person to get at the main problem more swiftly. I don't know what would happen if you just came in. Like, I mean, I remember the first time I ever talked to a therapist, I went in there and I was just like, I don't even know where to start. It's such a tangle. It's just all wound up like a big ball of spaghetti. And she just said, just start anywhere. That's my job.
Yeah, that's right.
Right?
Yeah.
And that was very like, just put me at ease. Like, you know, like there's this one snake, but it's tied in with all these other snakes. And, you know,
right.
Because life is complicated. But maybe most people, after they've lived with this pile of snakes for 40 years, they can kind of figure out what the central snake is. Yeah. And then you can talk to a therapist about that. And if they can help you unlock how that first thing got started in you, it can make a lot of sense out of things. So,
oh, yeah. No, that does make sense. And that's a lot of what psychodynamic is about, is getting to the root of the early patterns that are dragging mm-hmm. you down. So, I mean, if someone can find the key, you know, the main, like you said, the main snake, that would be useful in a couple of sessions, sure.
Yeah. Well, I remember you saying once that part of your work is to help people develop a coherent worldview for themselves,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
Could you talk about that a little bit?
Well, I think that is what I talked about in the little panel that we had, is like people cannot differentiate from what they have absorbed from other people, narratives that they've absorbed from other people, and what society tells them and what they actually believe and feel and think. So it's getting a sense of who someone really is without all the, you know, the contaminating messages, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
And allowing someone, you know, allowing people to, like people allowing themselves to have the freedom of their true selves versus being trapped by old narratives that other people have put on them, often parents, and that that those narratives seem dangerous to drop until you realize you can drop them.
Mm-hmm. Well, because you have to have some. You have to have some frame, right? So, maybe it is dangerous to drop a frame until you've worked out what your new frame is.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And move in the direction of your spontaneous expression versus, you know, what's been stifled or waylaid, mm-hmm. redirected by your upbringing.
Mm-hmm.
Or even later things that happen.
Yeah, I mean, that really makes sense to me because I like almost everybody else, I grew up in a dysfunctional and maybe not like everybody else. I was just a fog mm-hmm. really until I was probably 30 years old. I mean, I was still doing things, living life, and probably people watching from the outside thought, oh, that's a perfectly normal person. I mean, maybe they didn't. I don't know. but inside my own head, I had no idea really who I was, or, you know, I just sort of fell into things and then I would do it, whatever it was I fell into. And and so coming out of that fog and trying to figure out who you are is just it's very complicated.
It's complicated.
Yeah.
And especially if you've got so many unconscious patterns that seem to be reality that you have not yet discerned aren't really you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, I don't know. Does a person ever get completely out of that? Every once in a while I still have thoughts like, you know, am I still living in a delusion? You know, a fantasy world, because most of the time I have this very coherent worldview. And one of the things I do recognize about myself is that, and I didn't come to this recognition until probably 10 years ago. So it's pretty scary. I'm 65 years old when this aha comes to me. Wait a minute. I'm not living according to the values that I say that I have.
Yeah. Right.
That's like a terrifying, like, I'm talking about these, I'm talking about my worldview and my values and everything. I don't live those values, really. And so coming to that recognition was a huge aha for me. And I still, there's still areas of my values that I'm not living out. And that's and I sometimes wonder, is that a normal experience? Can everybody, can are there people who can 100% live out their values?
Well, I think you'd have to be some kind of ascetic to do that.
Oh, okay.
Because I think that, maybe what you're talking about also is as you develop spiritually, since that's a big part of your life, these values take on more, you have a fuller understanding of what it means. So
Yeah, well, that's true. That's
you may
really
be
true.
thinking you're living up to your values, but your understanding of these values change. So maybe you are living up to these values at one point. Then the what these values mean change as you develop spiritually,
Deeper and deeper,
deeper
deeper.
and
I'm
deeper and
assuming.
deeper. So that requires you to, reevaluate your behavior, to word, but that awakening is really awakening to a new self versus that you were bad in the past and now you're,
I mean,
so.
that's exactly the same as the experience of developing as an artist. It's exactly the same trajectory
Totally,
because
totally.
you have a vision of what you want to accomplish and you go after it and then you're done and it's like, that did not live up to my vision at all. Well, what do I need in order to live up to that vision? Well, I need to develop this skill, this skill, this skill, this skill. So then I go out and I develop those skills and then I try again. Only now my vision has gone a little further on. Now I try that vision and whoops, I'm not there yet. So I have to go develop this skill and this skill and this, and yeah, it's exactly the same. That's exactly the same paradigm. Thank you. That clears things up. See, you fixed me.
Rapid, what is a rapid
Rapid
response?
response therapy. Or maybe no, maybe it's rapid resolution therapy.
Have to
That
look
makes more
that
sense.
up. Yeah, I'll have to look that
It's RRT anyway.
up. Okay, all right, definitely. I'll see. I mean, maybe that's something I can get out of that for sure.
And I had a conversation with, oh gosh, who is that? Bruce Ecker, who does something called coherence therapy. And I think that verges on this RRT thing a little bit. So that was a very interesting conversation with him. Some of my viewers had pointed him out to me.
When did you do that one?
Maybe 2 months ago,
Oh, okay.
Bruce Ecker, some kind of coherent, I can't remember the first word, but it's coherence therapy. And it's something he actually developed.
Oh, sure.
And he's written the book about it and he's got a whole organization and everything.
Well, that is the case with a lot of people develop modalities.
So that's what they mean when they say modality.
And there, there's many of them all over the place now, and some of them are great.
So when you heard Jordan Peterson talking about what he did when he was a clinical, when he was a clinician, how would you characterize his approach?
Well, I think he was trained in psychoanalysis. He has an interest in Jung, and I think that he pursued that on his own. But he also does CBT. I mean, like at the basis of a lot of the stuff he talks about is exposure therapy.
Is that the root of CBT is exposure therapy?
That's an element. That's something that would fall under that umbrella.
And exposure therapy is when you determine what it is that you're afraid of, and then you move time little bits towards it in order
That's
to
right.
develop your courage.
Yeah, with a voluntary approach. I mean, you have to want to do it. Because if your therapist makes you do it, then that can make it worse.
Well, and I mean that's probably where so many of the problems start with parenting because parent doesn't understand how important the voluntary side is in any sort of learning. I mean, you think you're helping by promoting or pushing certain things, but really without the voluntary aspect, then there's no freedom there. There's no learning. So
now then the kid's just doing it to please their parents.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, the other thing about Jordan Peterson, I forgot. And I mentioned this during the panel. One person and one thing that made me really relate to him is is Carl Rogers. Are you familiar with his approach?
Well, only from what I've heard from Jordan Peterson, unconditional positive regard.
Yeah. And that's like mirroring back to, it's like you, as they speak, you repeat back to them in a way what they're saying, to the point that you are saying back to them exactly what they are trying to convey to you. And that might, you know, that takes some adjusting, because you can think that you know what they're saying, but when you summarize it back to them, it may be totally wrong. So the therapy in Carl Rogers is getting that right, you know, getting like, and helping them on, you know, and by doing this, helping them develop into someone who feels, thinks, and act in the same way, that it lines up in congruence, you know.
I mean, I can totally get that. I mean, okay, so pop culture, like marriage stuff, which I've gone through some, we've gone through some in the past, they typify that as drive-through communication. Mm-hmm. So like you're going to McDonald's and you say, I want a burger, no pickles, and then I want a protein burger, lettuce wrapped, and then I want a soda and a coffee, black. No, make that with cream. And then they come back and they say, you want a protein wrap with no pickles? No, I want a regular burger with no pickles and a protein wrap with, you know. So you get that right then, right? So they call that drive-through communication.
Well, that makes sense. I think it's based on that.
Yeah. So, but one of the other things that I noticed is that a lot of times I don't really know how to process what it is I believe until I've talked it through with somebody. So there's something about language that actually builds structure at the same time that, so if you're talking with a therapist and they're getting you to say over and over again what it is you really believe, sometimes I hear myself saying it and I think, yeah, I'm saying this, but that's not really what I believe, right?
That's right.
And then I'll adjust as I go along.
Yeah.
And until I can get to what it is that I actually believe. And then by that time, they can also meet up with my mountain and then we're on the same page, right?
That makes a lot of sense.
I mean, is that kind of the thing that you're talking about with Carl Rogers?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that's certainly another way of, yeah. I mean, like you were talking about the congruence, you're helping them know themselves, like their beliefs, and like mm-hmm. you're saying, in the process of doing this therapy, where the therapist is trying to understand what you're saying, is trying to really get you. You are also trying to get yourself, because you're trying to convey your true self to the therapist.
Yeah.
And then that, you know, attempt to convey yourself, you're adjusting, like you said, until you get what feels right. And then when everything is congruent, that's where they're trying to get to. That's mm-hmm. what type of therapy is trying to get to. And you do it with the, you know, within the safe space of unconditional positive regard. You're not trying to, you know, you're trying to let the person just be who they are. Because a lot of times kids, you know, when they're little kids, they're not allowed to be angry and they're not allowed to be who they really are because it's inconvenient to the parent.
Well, that's part of it, is inconvenient, especially if you have to get somewhere, especially if it's something that the kid has to get to because of some, don't get there, they're not going to end up at Yale or whatever, right?
Well, no, and I mean, some of that stuff, not so much the logistical stuff or, you know, how to behave in society in some kind of way so you're not just running around as like a hellion, which some kids are, but like, you know, that your anger isn't valid. You shouldn't be angry about this. you shouldn't be upset about that.
Yeah, yeah.
You just suppress these emotions because they're not convenient to me because I don't want to see them.
Oh yeah, I mean that kind of thing. I can totally see that. I can see that back in my own parenting. Mm-hmm. That, because there again, I mean, it's like when Jordan Peterson talks about cleaning your room.
Uh-huh.
There's this pile of papers over in the corner that you haven't gone through and put away
yeah,
yet because
yeah.
it's a pile of snakes.
Yeah.
And so there are just things that are inconvenient to look at the moment that cause people to make, well, I mean, for I'll speak for myself, that can cause me to make decisions in the moment that are damaging not only to myself, but to other people. And then you look back on it later and you're like, I just can't believe I did that, you know? But that's also part of the problem. Why am I saying I can't believe I did that? That if I was capable of never doing anything like that, then I would be perfect, right? And I'm not perfect, obviously. So obviously I've done all kinds of things that not only have not exposed my own snakes, but have created snakes for other people. I'm laughing about it, but it isn't really a funny thing. It's really, in many ways, very tragic. It's one of the things we deal with. But I mean, that was one of the things that really spoke to me at Chino, is how in the estuary groups, it always felt as though we were all coming at it with unconditioned positive regard and really trying to understand each other.
Yeah. So what is your, so that's, I totally agree. And we were in the same Chino group. So we've got, you know, I know what your experiences, or at least I know what it was like to be in the room with you and these people at the same time. Mm-hmm. So we've got cross reference, but I'm interested, what's your impression of Chino?
Well, like, I was telling Tayo the other day
takeaways.
that my big takeaway was how lovely it was to I guess what it is that we all have the same foundation because we've all been following the same thread for a year or 2 years or 4 years, however long we've been working on whatever it is that we're doing in this little corner. So we all have the same foundation.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that it would be impossible for a new person coming in, because a new person could come in and, like, even talking to Tayo, he only got into this a couple of years ago, and he caught up pretty fast because he was willing to listen to 300 or 400 hours of video, right? But when you all have the same foundation, then when you come together, you have a certain place where you can start, and then mm-hmm. you can treat each other as if we're all more or less on enough of the same page that we have a place to start in our conversation.
Yeah, that's really true.
And then the other thing is this assumption of trust, that we're just assuming you trust me and I can trust you, and we can speak openly because of that.
Yeah.
And you know, I mean, I've thought a lot about trust, and for me, and I don't know how this works for everybody else, but for me, one of the reasons that I can trust is because I'm not trusting so much the other person as I am trusting God, or as Jordan Peterson would say, I'm trusting that being is good, fundamentally good. So I can be open, I can be honest about who I am without fearing utter destruction, because I believe God is good. And if he's calling me to be honest, he's gonna work things out. Maybe not always with a good consequence. Maybe there's going to be some terrible consequence that comes out of it, but there will be a purpose even in that. And so that is what allows the trust. Now, I don't know what that is for other people.
But it did seem like the trust you're talking about, and the higher purpose that we were all, that was guiding us, really, it seemed to resonate there. I mean, that's not very unusual to be in a situation like that, where people aren't, where there just isn't any negativity, really. I mean, if there's negativity, it's about people saying, I had this painful experience. But there's nothing like complaining about, you go to conferences that aren't like this, that are for some other thing, some commercial venture, some professional venture, and people will be complaining and they'll be talking about other people and they'll be talking about the leadership and there'll be all sorts of things like that. And there was none of that there.
Yeah, I know.
I
Wasn't it lovely?
know. Yes.
When can we do it
No.
again?
And you didn't see people on their phones nonstop. I mean, they're using their phones to look things up or show you share videos or take photos, but you just didn't see what you see in the everyday world. You know what I mean?
Well, and there were many people who had made a commitment to completely get off of social media so that they would have more time to do their life.
Yeah.
Because once they've come to a place where they feel like they have responsibilities in life and they want to carry out those responsibilities, I mean, I just met some lovely people. There was one guy I met, I hope I get a chance to talk to, but he's very busy, obviously, because he has a very responsible life. But he and his wife were at one time missionaries. Well, missionary is a loose word. I'm not exactly sure what their
Yeah.
category would have been, but they were working with abused women in Nepal,
That's right. Yeah.
right? And then he really believed that part of what they should be doing is building a family by adopting children who are maybe in the social work system or something where they desperately need a family. And so they specifically moved to Canada so that they could adopt abandoned children. It's easier to adopt children, I guess, in Canada, or maybe Canada provides some financial incentive for adoption. Not incentive, but makes it less expensive. Like
Yeah.
in the States, adopting a child can cost way more than having
Sure,
a baby
sure.
in the hospital.
So they subsidize the adoption of
Canada subsidizes to some extent the adoption. And so they've already adopted four children. They were working on number five, and they do little videos once in a while when they get a new child, and then it just
Oh,
shows the family. And
no.
I mean it's just lovely. And what was so cool was because they're very, very busy with all these children and with their work and everything. So they split their work. He does window washing as a job so that he can work in the summer and the fall. Or maybe it's the summer and the fall. And then she has a different kind of business that she can do in the winter and the spring.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
So they can take turns parenting 6 months at a time
So
while
they're
the other
both
one is
something there.
earning
Yeah.
the money for them. And I thought, this is such a creative way to build a life, right?
Oh,
And so that they can serve in the way that they feel they're called to serve. But then that makes you very busy. So you don't have time for social media, right?
yeah. Yeah.
Because you're actually trying to help raise up people to be new people in our world that are loved and cared for. And yeah, I met lots of lovely people like that. And
Yeah, I remember him. I don't remember his name, but I was really impressed by that.
yeah. And I heard many other stories, and it's just so great to meet people who, and in many cases it now in their case it wasn't, I don't think, but in many cases I met people who had been moved by Jordan Peterson or by John Verbeke or by Paul Vanderclay to make a difference in their life and to come to a place of responsibility. And that's just very encouraging to see that there is a way that the world can change, because We're attacked relentlessly by the negativity in the media.
Isn't it unbelievable?
Yeah. Where you just feel like the world is, how can this ever, it's so hopeless. How can this ever change? That's so the message that they're giving us all the time.
It's comforting.
At Chino, you see all these people who are making a life and confronting voluntarily the snakes in their life and confronting voluntarily their fears and working in whatever way they personally can to improve their own life and improve the lives of their family members and then moving outward. You know, it's the whole picture. You start at ground zero and work on that. I'm still looking at this pile of snakes in my office. It's so easy to find excuses and say, well, you know, because I'm busy, I don't have time to tackle that pile of snakes. But really, it's just a pile of snakes.
Yep. Yeah, that's like one of the biggest problems most people have is getting that motivation to do these things we should do to clean up our room.
Well, I mean, I just have to be honest here.
I'm not even going to show you mine. That's snake's light.
That was only half of it. Here's the other half.
Yeah, there's some organization.
Just snakes everywhere.
There's an undercurrent of organization.
Well, one of the other things I've noticed happening recently, and this gives me real hope, and I don't know, I have no idea if this goes back to Jordan Peterson or if there's just a current in the air now that things are possible. Mm-hmm. But one of the guys I love listening to online is a guy by the name of John Ortberg. He's written many books. Mm-hmm. He has a YouTube channel now called Become New. Mm-hmm. And he just every day he does a 10 or 15 minute thing. And sometimes he might go through a book, like he went through a book by Dallas Willard and talked about it little by little every day. Uh-huh. Right now he's going through the book of Genesis.
Interesting.
And his message just a couple days ago was this idea of the snake. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what does the snake represent? You know, was it really a talking serpent, you know, or does it represent this larger entity that we can allow to control our lives? And what is the snake that you're allowing to control you today? You know, he got right at it. And obviously, Jordan Peterson wasn't the first one to talk about that. You can go back to the church fathers who have been talking about that. But for me, it's something new to hear people in the church using this symbolic language, mm-hmm. and using it in a way, not I've heard this before when pastors are trying to bring up an application from a passage. Mm-hmm. It was just different in the way he approached it. It just felt much more like what we talk about in our corner.
Yeah, more of the approach, right?
The message at church on Sunday was one of the young pastors, and he was talking about Noah's Ark. Mm-hmm. And the way he taught that was, I would say, pretty close to what Jordan Peterson was doing when he talked about Noah's Ark. And so, I mean, he was still coming at it from a biblical perspective, not a psychological perspective, but he used a lot of the same kind of symbolic ideas. And so to hear that coming from the pulpit, mm-hmm. was just very encouraging to think, so people are trying to find another way to reach this generation that's not watering it down and making it something easy to absorb, but that's making you dig a little bit deeper.
Yeah,
that was very encouraging. It was quite a message.
Because you can, because you have to sort of have, you can't have something so abstract or something so, something you can't really get a hold of. And I think that, you know, for me, I think that, you know how Jonathan Peugeot says, yes, these stories are real, but they're real in a meta kind of way. You know, and I think that, like, you're not like, it's not exactly about going and seeing, you know, going back in a time capsule and revisiting these stories and seeing it happen just as it plays out in the Bible. This is something much deeper than that. And I think that if people can see the difference, you know, I think that's what puts people off, is the scientific, like, this is what Jonathan says, the scientific interpretation of the Bible, like a lot of the fundamentalist interpretation has a tendency to be a science lens. You know, this actually happened. And if you don't, like, the ultimate truth is scientific. And if you don't agree with the ultimate scientific truth, then that's heretical.
Mm-hmm.
When there's something really, like, heretical in itself by looking at it through a scientific lens.
Well, that has to be, because if you go back and I have not read that much of the church fathers, but once in a while I go back and I'm doing some research and I'll look at something. And someone had asked me a question about this Noah's Ark message that I wanted to pursue a little bit, which I thought was a very good question. So I went searching and I ran into a message that Bishop Barron had done about Origen's, Origen's opinion of Noah's Ark. And when you read Barron's message about Origen's perspective, it reads almost exactly like Jordan Peterson's perspective.
Yeah.
And this is going back into the very early beginnings
That's
of
so
the church.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
So, and I mean, Jordan Peterson's perspective on Noah's Ark is not that it happens. It's what always happens. Because what always happens is that when people stop focusing on God and stop looking upward and trying to build their society around this upward, you know, gratitude and humility, they fall into chaos and they're consumed by the flood. And it happens every time. And like Jordan Peterson was teaching, he talked about Soviet Union, he talked about Nazi Germany, he talked about Mao's China, that when it came to a place where the people were no longer courageous enough to speak the truth or to stand for truth, the whole society collapses and they are subsumed by the flood.
Yeah.
And it's not that the flood comes as a punishment. The flood comes as an inevitable consequence of the behavior. And that's true even in the little floods in our lives.
That's right, yeah.
Right? So, you know, one of the things I struggle with is trying to maintain a healthy weight, because food is a convenient fix for things, just like anything else. And so God's not punishing me with not being able to go out and buy pretty clothes. it's an inevitable consequence, you know. Uh-huh. And the other thing is, our bodies are built with a certain frame and bone structure that is built to manage a certain amount of weight, and it's physics. It's just physics. Mm-hmm. So if you are abusing that balance by carrying too much weight, it's going to have a physical impact on your body. It's going to. It's not like somebody is punishing you with having, you know, bad hips or something. It's you've been carrying too much weight on your bones. Therefore, you know, and I just think there's so much of life that's like that, that there just is a reality. And when we try to make reality in our own image, there's going to be consequences.
Yeah.
It's not a hammer coming down on you. It's
you're right.
The way it is.
Yeah. You have to be in harmony with the natural order of things. Otherwise things are going to fall apart.
Yeah.
And I think that something like, you know, to go into weight and food and all that stuff. I mean, on a macro scale, you've got a system that is much more interested, that is not interested in nourishing its public. Learned how to add vitamins to food, so you don't have vitamin deficiency. And you can take those vitamins, those artificial vitamins, and put them in all these horrible corn-based products that is the sum total, you know, that's like probably 40% of the food produced is corn-based, you know, genetically modified. And it's like these highly profitable products. And so, and then you see the health of the population begin to fall apart because of that. And then so they fix that with more products, pharmaceutical products, and you see this is a giant mess.
Yeah, I mean, it's a giant market for sure.
Yeah, but when it comes to like our actual biological relationship with the origin of our, you know, of who we are with the earth, there's all this stuff in between that now. There's us going and hunter, you know, being hunter-gatherers, I suppose, would be the earliest example of that. To now, where you've got all these layers of product in between the earth and you. And so there's this up here is just going to have so many side effects that constantly have to be fixed with something else that's going to have a side effect rather than that, you know, the natural relationship that we once had.
Well, but I can speak as one with authority that even when, and I do generally try to eat as close to the earth as I can. You know, I don't shop the inner section of the store. I only shop around the perimeter, which is the
Oh,
fresh
yeah, the produce.
vegetables that, you know, right, and the organic meat and, you know, no hormones. And, you know, I try as much as possible to get natural foods and eat those natural foods. Guess what? Even when you're eating the right stuff, you can still abuse your body by eating too much of the right stuff because you can, I mean, I can always convince myself, well, you know, this little bit won't hurt, or, you know, a little extra ounce of meat there, you know, whatever. Or I don't need to weigh that because I know how much this is. And so I'm using this as an example, not to just point at my own stuff, but I'm saying this kind of thing can happen in any part of life where it's possible to make excuses about everything. Oh, I heard this great line the other day. One of There's a couple of people that I talk to offline that we never record because they don't like to record. But he made this statement that philosophy is a marketplace for excuses. I thought that was so good
That's really funny.
because it's true. If you want to live a world of excuses instead of a world of responsibility, you just go find the right philosopher
That's
or
right.
pick here and there from different philosophers that will support your position, right? So, because I am a sinner, you know, Lord Jesus Christ, Son of God, have mercy on me, a sinner. And it permeates every single layer. And that, again, that the word sinner doesn't mean what people think it means. You know,
It's
what it
that
means
being
is
out of
the missing the mark, just missing the mark. And when we continually miss the mark, we're getting closer and closer to the place that the whole society is covered by the flood.
Totally. Yeah, more and more out of harmony. More following the wrong, you know, that's what Jonathan would say, following the wrong, you know, like what is at the top of the hierarchy in that case is not the right top. It's not the
Yeah,
right
not the
entity
right
to follow.
spirit. So I don't know if you saw that tweet that Matthew Pajot put out today about the story about the king with the mirror.
No, I haven't looked at Twitter today, but tell me.
I'll see if I can copy paste it maybe into the well, he was saying that there was something he wanted to talk to us about, but he'd been getting so many attacks from other people whenever he approaches that topic that he feels like maybe there's something more underneath that that he needs to investigate.
That's interesting.
And so before he's going to come out publicly with his thoughts, he wants to spend some more time in reflection and contemplation.
This is his King David project, right?
Well, I don't know, but in this particular tweet, he made that statement that I just said, and then he posted a story about a king, an evil king, an inverted king, who took all his wealth and turned it into the most highly polished gold mirror that he could create. And then that mirror was used as a way to capture everybody.
Right.
So there's no way to defeat the king, because every time people would come into his presence, they'd see their reflection in the mirror and they'd get so captivated by their reflection in the mirror. Or they would be so afraid that the mirror would expose their hidden desires that they would give in to the king. And then the question at the end is, if you reveal your light and then your light is captured by the mirror, if you don't reveal your light, then you are captured by the mirror, then how can you overcome such a king? Because you know it's a riddle, it's a story, and I'm sure it's probably like a Zen koan. He's probably going to get us thinking about what that means.
Let me read that last line because I found it here. How can the fallen king be defeated? When you withhold your light, you cannot use it. But when you reveal it, the mirror steals it.
Yeah, there you go. I didn't have it quite right. When you withhold your light, you cannot use it. So if your light is covered with a bushel basket, it's useless. But if you reveal your light and the mirror steals it, there's a couple of verses that come to mind when I think about that. One is that it talks about how we are like those who look into a mirror, look intently into a mirror and then walk away and forget what it was that we saw. There's a lot of levels to that. Another one is talking about the eye being the lamp of the body, then therefore, if the light that is in you is darkness, what's the rest of that verse? Anyway, the idea is that if you're taking in what you think is light, but if what you're taking in is darkness, really, then you have no light within. But the way to have the light within is to be completely open about, not to have any hidden desires, I think would be the thing, because it's the hidden desires that bankrupt these people, right?
Well, so, I think you're talking about the lens you see things through, right? I mean, you see things through a distorted dark lens, things will seem bad and negative.
Well, yeah, I think it's a different verse. Let me see if I can find it. So, it's lamp of the body in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus Christ. Okay, Matthew 6, 22, 23. The eye is the lamp of the body. If your eyes are good, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eyes are bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. Well, I guess that would be if you're looking through a darkened lens, you're going to see darkness.
Yeah.
But then the verse I was thinking of is, if then the light within you is darkness, how great is that darkness? So if the light within you is darkness, how great then is that darkness? So if all we ever take in is the negative, then there's no light to be gotten. That's one aspect of it. But I also think the other thing he's talking about with that story is that we can be controlled if we have hidden desires, because we're afraid that those hidden desires will be exposed. It's the same way that blackmailers get by with controlling people, right?
Well, what would be the then that's a very good point. What would be how to deal with the fallen king, how would you deal with the blackmailer?
Well, I think the story has to be, and I don't even know how this is possible, but the story has to be that that there's nothing about you. Number one, if you went the ascetic route, there would be nothing about you that anybody could blackmail you for. But if you already have stuff in your past, like people who have social media accounts and there's stuff lurking in the past and all of that, you have to come to a place of such courage that it doesn't matter what is exposed, you're
That's
not
right.
going to allow that to control you.
That's right. I
Right?
think that's exactly it. I think that's exactly right. You know, you are accepting of your sins and failures, and you stand up to them, and you like you said, the word is courage. You have the courage to withstand what people have to say about that stuff. And be, you know, where you are now is what counts.
And even if where we are now is not perfect, we still, at some point, I think this trust thing has to come into it.
That's right.
That I'm trusting that God is good and that no matter what comes of this, I have to be, the modern word is transparent, and so
Well, that's truthful
maybe
with
that's too much
yourself.
of a cliche, but there is something about it. If you're transparent, the mirror can't capture you.
You're truthful with yourself. If
Yes.
you understand, and even if you know you've done bad things in the past, the mirror is going to capture you. You take responsibility for your past and you resolve, and that's what forgiveness is about, right? You
Right.
resolve to learn from this and be better in the future. You know, there's a whole lot of ways of putting this, but I think that makes sense. And it's also the whole stance that we're talking about in this little corner.
That was very important for you at Chino, was to try to determine the stance. Could you
Yeah.
talk about that a little bit?
Well, I think the stance is kind of what you're talking about. You know, it's like having the light. It's opening your eyes so that the light comes in. It's unintended, you know, it's unconditional positive regard. It's the vibe that was at Chino. It's like being in the room with people and trusting them. And trusting, you know, and the trusting that following your conscience and following God, let's say, will lead you in the right direction versus believing what you're told.
Yeah, I think that conscience has to be guided by it is perfectly possible for a person to have a conscience that's not guided by truth.
Totally. I think that's right. So
Right. So I mean,
you
this is
probably
where I think the word comes in, because we have the word, and what many people often do is they take one little passage of scripture and then they make that their centerpiece, but you cannot take any part of the scripture out of the context of the whole. So when you do that without recognizing how it fits into the whole and all the other things that are said that are adjacent to that, then you can easily get misled and you can get a conscience that gets twisted. I mean, you were talking about children who are pushed into doing things because of the fears of the parents. Then that creates in the child a conscience that it can be overly self-critical and damaging.
Yeah.
Right. And so then that's still a conscience, but it's going to lead you in the wrong direction.
Sure.
So the conscience has to be balanced with what the guidance of the word says,
yeah,
and not the word as it has been twisted by some
That's right.
leaders who choose to use the word for their own purposes, who have their own hidden desires, like the people who are trapped by the mirror, right?
Yeah.
But it has to be people who have a desire to understand the whole word and be honest about it and ask honest questions and really understand, you know, to see the word as fundamentally good and trustworthy. And then, yeah, I mean, these things are complicated.
Yeah.
It would be so nice to be able to simplify it down, you know, and make it easy to.
But it's also, like you said, having the courage to accept what the mirror reflects back to you,
mm-hmm.
and to commit to fixing that or going forward to not allow that to continue. Whatever way that is. I mean, if you learn that your parents, you know, that you've got some old patterns that your parents have put on you, and if you feel like it's dangerous to let those patterns go, you kind of have to work on, like you said, getting a better framework so where you can let those patterns go. So it's really, a lot of it's about not allowing, you know, a lot of it is about letting your ego go, like you said, humility.
Mm-hmm.
And the stance is one of letting your ego go when it needs to.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because you're not going to make these changes if they're damaging to your ego. If you can't stand seeing what's reflected back to you in the mirror, then you're not going to make the changes.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I don't know how it is for other people, but for me, I usually sleep pretty well. And even when I wake up in the middle of the night, I can get back to sleep. But when on the nights when I can't get back to sleep, it's because some regret has been brought back into my memory of something from the past that I've done that I know very well has damaged people. And then it's so easy to get trapped in that and feel like I can't fix that.
Mm-hmm.
Because it happened,
mm-hmm.
and it's past, and but then ultimately the only way that I can handle that is to come back to the place of remembering, yeah, I can't fix that. I'm not God, but there is one who is, and he can, and
yeah.
He loves that person even more than I do,
mm-hmm.
and he is willing and able not only to restore the years that the locusts have eaten, but to make something beautiful out of that,
mm-hmm.
for his greater purpose, whatever that is, you know. There's this old song we used to sing, something beautiful, something good. All my confusion, he understood. Can't remember the end of it. If I had been singing it, I would have remembered the end of it, but I'm not going to sing online. So, but anyway, the song is just something beautiful. And really, he can make something beautiful out of the broken pieces of our past. And that is what allows me to sleep again, you know.
I think that's right. You take responsibility, but you forgive yourself because he forgives you.
Yeah, I mean, well, what other path is there to get forward, you know? I mean,
there isn't.
If you get trapped in those regrets of the past, then maybe that's what the mirror is.
I think so. And
right?
Also, yeah, I think that's right. And also, then that you're also, like, to dwell on the bad things you did is also giving into your ego.
Yes, yes.
You know,
giving
saying,
too much power to your...
Too much power to... your and this is really it's kind of a catch 22. It's giving too much power to your regret.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like there's almost a self-indulgence to regret that doesn't allow you to go forward and do good in the world,
mm-hmm.
because you're feeling sorry for yourself that you did this bad thing.
Yeah, yeah. That reminds me of this one time I was really struggling with something with a it was probably some attitude I was having that I was struggling with, and knowing that I was in the wrong place. And I called up one of the women in my small group who was more mature than I was, and I was just, you know, kind of crying and saying I know I should be better. And she said, "Who do you think you are to think that you should be better?" You're just like the rest of us.
That's funny.
Yeah.
That's
if I always knew the right thing to do, then I would be saying that I'm God. And,
yeah.
And you know, I'm not. Now, that's not to excuse making mistakes or having wrong attitudes or whatever. But sometimes even when I believe I'm doing the absolute right thing, and this is what I feel I'm called to do, and I really believe I'm doing the right thing, and it turns out to have this destructive impact.
Yeah.
What do I do with that? You know? So either I'm God and I have all the answers, or I'm not and I don't. And I know which one I'm going to fall yeah. into, right? I am not and I don't. But I know the one who does, and I can trust him, so that all I can do is try to do the right thing. And if I do the wrong thing, then I have to trust that somehow he has a way out of that for me.
Yeah.
Right.
And that you learn from that.
Yes.
That's the way out for you.
Yeah. Well, I didn't mean to use up your therapy time with my own issues, but it's nice to get your wisdom on this stuff. And
well, it's really nice to talk to you and catch up.
Yeah. So what do you have plans for the summer?
Do I have plans for summer? Not really. You're going to Hawaii?
We are going to Hawaii as a family next week, and really looking forward to that.
Good.
Just have relaxing time together. You know, my husband works long hours, days, and it's fun to watch him relax, although usually it takes him almost the whole week of the vacation to get relaxed.
Do you think he'll stay away from his work?
Most of the time he does, although he doesn't like to see things fall apart.
Yeah.
Fall through the cracks. And so if he sees things starting to fall apart, he'll jump in a little bit and say, you know, hey, remember that thing over there. Yeah. So, you know, I mean, I've gotten used to it. There, part of living in Silicon Valley is that I think you have to learn to balance your life. So because they're communicating with people from all over the planet all the time.
Yeah.
If he's talking to India or Europe or China or Australia or Israel, it's all different time zones.
Mm-hmm.
So occasionally he'll have to take a call at 5:30 a.m. Occasionally he'll have to take a call at 8:30 at night.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So he's found a way to integrate life into his day so that he's not working from 5:30 a.m. to 8:30 at night, but he's, you know, once in a while he can take a break and go do
right.
something, spend time with me, integrate life into the work day, and then integrate a little bit of work into the life days. And it works for us, and it's not been a burden, but it does allow him to excel in what he does, and I like to see that, right?
For sure.
Yeah, so it's all good.
All right, well, have a great time in Hawaii then. I'm glad your daughter's going with you.
Yeah, and
so let's catch up.
I hope you have a summer in DC that's not too hot. My recollection of DC in the summer is pretty grueling.
Yeah, it can be bad. Right now I'm in Maryland, but I'll be in DC in a couple of weeks.
Okay.
Yeah, which but the weather's the same. So yeah, no big plans. So maybe go to the beach at the end of the summer.
So what are you doing with your channel these days?
Not much.
Not because you're done with Persig. You're just
No,
taking a
I
break.
just I'm just I put stuff on. I talked about the stance a little bit. So I put a few videos on. But no, I'm not done talking about Persig. He's always part of the mix.
I noticed you tweeted out something yesterday.
Oh yeah. I was rereading Persig, which I tend to do. And then, if it's an electronic book, which it was, I can cut and paste. So I have to do that.
And what you put out there was that everybody is always striving towards quality, or there's a natural desire to strive
Yeah.
towards quality. And so I made the comment. I said, unless you're one of the powers that be in the silo, did you know what I was talking about?
and like the people who are sort of in control.
Well, no, there's a TV, there's a new series on Apple
Oh no,
Plus.
I didn't. I thought it was
There's
the
a
mom.
new series on Apple Plus called The Silo.
Oh, okay. No, I didn't know what you're talking
Absolutely fascinating and
about.
filled with all sorts of symbolic stuff that is so much under the surface that it's really kind of hard to understand what they're getting at, but endlessly fascinating. And the leaders of the silo really don't want people to excel, which when you look at that, you have to think, what on earth could be their motivation for not wanting? I mean, it becomes very obvious when you watch people who are trying to prevent advancements and prevent progress. What could be the motivation for that? You know? If there's a natural desire to strive for quality, then when that natural desire is allowed to flourish in individuals, then the quality rises to the surface and you keep getting more and more quality, right? Isn't that the way it should work? Is that what Persig is talking about?
It's like we'd have to do another in a way,
In a way. Okay, well, that makes
in a way.
So anyway, I think that there again, this whole voluntary thing is what comes into play. And so if people are going to move towards quality, there needs to be a voluntary ability to do that.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah. So, well, I won't steal your thunder then. You can talk about that on your channel, but
Well, I'd have to think about it a little
yeah,
bit.
but I am recommending that if anybody gets a chance to watch The Silo on Apple Plus, and I'm not getting a cut from Apple on this.
That's
It's
funny.
just, I watch it with my daughter. We watch it online together, even though
Oh,
she's in
that's
another
brilliant.
city.
Yeah.
And so we can talk to each other while it's going on. And it's like, what? He did what? What was he doing? Why? Yeah, it's really good. It's about some dystopian future where the only supposedly the only 10,000 people left on Earth are living in this silo that's down underground. And it's just so endlessly fascinating. Well, anyway, I've talked enough. It was good seeing you, Sevilla.
Great to see you. Let's do it again next month.
Yes. Okay, that sounds really good. July. Yeah, my 75th birthday is coming up next
Well,
month.
hard to believe.
I have to
Really.
think about some kind of celebration for that. I'll tell you this, since I joined this little corner, I feel 20 years younger. So
Well, you look 20 years younger and you act 20 years younger in a good way. So.
do you. Okay.
All
Have a great day.
right, Karen, you take
Yeah.
care.
Bye-bye.